Welcome to Passing Years CAM Podcast, Conversations on Error Digestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guest, Ashley Lopez, having a conversation on disorders of consciousness and early intervention.
I want to thank everyone for joining and listening in on this podcast. Today, I'm talking with Ashley Lopez, a speech-language pathologist from Houston Methodist Continuing Care Hospital in Texas, with the Texas Medical Center and working with the LTAC division. Ashley has a background, of course, as a speech-language pathologist, but she's also board-certified in swallowing and swallowing disorders, and just recently completed her MBA. Congratulations, Ashley, on that. Do you have anything else you'd like to share just about your experience? You know, how long you've been working as a clinician? I know you do some work with ASHA. Is there anything with any of that you'd like to share with everybody listening?
Absolutely. I'd love to. So I have been a speech language pathologist for 10 years now. I definitely started out in grad school wanting to do something completely different. I thought I was going to do auditory verbal therapy, but I got into my first neuro class and I loved the adult population. I actually did extra coursework, my externships in TBI. So TBI is definitely my first love, but I ended up marrying dysphagia. I am now board certified in swallowing and swallowing disorders. I am a member of the professional development committee for SIG 13, which is the special interest group for ASHA for swallowing and swallowing disorders. And I also am on the board member for the Hispanic Caucus in ASHA. So I definitely love to contribute back to the profession and to help open the doors for other clinicians who want to do great things.
Well, thank you. I knew you had some involvement in different areas of ASHA, and I wanted to be sure that information was shared because you definitely are an advocate for other speech language pathologists. I've seen, you know, some of what you have shared with us in the articles. And then I know, like I said, that you have those other groups you work with. So thank you for all that you do. I wanted to have you on today because we get a lot of questions about working with patients with disorders of consciousness. And this is an area, well, you mentioned TBI being a first love. It's also a first love for me. And then you mentioned, I know you've worked with disorders of consciousness at your facility and that y'all have kind of a protocol in place that you use in working with these patients. So I wanted to talk a little bit about all of that and maybe help the listeners get a better feel for points to consider when they have these patients on their caseload, you know, things that they can do. So maybe we could start out just by even defining and kind of explaining what is a disorder of consciousness.
Yes, I think that's a great starting point. I think the best thing to do is understand the brain states or categories, truly understand which each one of those encompass. So I'm going to provide a little bit of foundation. The first stage is coma. And so that's when eyes are closed and there's absent interaction with the environment. And this can typically last several weeks or more if this is chemically induced. The next stage we go into, which we kind of colloquially know is vegetative state, but now has been introduced as the wakeful unresponsiveness. And that comes as the brainstem starts to activate. This is typically when the patient is starting to move or we're seeing some sort of spontaneous movement. And then we move into the minimally conscious state where the behaviors are becoming more frequent, but still inconsistent. So it's more frequent, inconsistent movement. And that is when typically we see that our patients are more stabilized and they're transitioning to the next level of care from the acute phase. And that's usually when patients are transitioning to a skilled nursing facility or long-term care facility and are missing out on that robust intervention that can be provided to these patients, that should be provided to these patients. There has been several works, Dr. Snakers and Dr. Siff have found that upwards of 45% of patients who kind of start out in this severe acquired brain injury, disorders of consciousness, will go to a skilled nursing facility as misdiagnosed as vegetative and unconscious. And, you know, when I learned that statistic and when I learned that there are things that can be done for this population, it definitely inspired me to pursue it and to make sure that my facility was honoring these patients with the appropriate and compassionate care.
You brought up actually a couple of points there I want to unpack a little bit, because you said acquired brain injury. So when you're looking at the definition of disorder of consciousness, and you described coma and what we previously thought of as vegetative state, are we looking at, and in your facility or broadly with the research that you've read, are we looking at patients with any type of neurological event causing a consciousness change, or are you looking more at traumatic brain injury, or, you know, does it include strokes and other diagnoses, or what categories do we have under that umbrella of disorders of consciousness?
That's a great question. So disorders of consciousness has typically been studied mostly in polytrauma units like the VA regarding traumatic brain injury. And we see a majority of that research in traumatic brain injury, but there's also anoxic brain injuries where we are seeing patients with disorders of consciousness. When we see patients with stroke, we can kind of get in a little gray area. We can maybe see patients with stroke who are locked in, and that is not a disorder of consciousness. That is actually a cognitive and motor disassociation without a cognitive impairment. Whereas a disorder of consciousness, there may be a motor disassociation, but there is a cognitive impairment.
Thank you for clarifying that, because I believe that's one area that sometimes gets a little bit confused when we're looking at this patient population and what we can do with them. You also mentioned the research study where 45% were being sent into facilities with kind of a misdiagnosis. Can you explain that a little bit more about what that misdiagnosis was?
Absolutely. So one of the hallmark things of disorders of consciousness treatment, and is fiercely advocated by Dr. Joe Giacino, who is a neuropsychologist that specializes and dedicated his life to disorders of consciousness, has always recommended serial assessments atop of behavioral and neuroimaging to be able to appropriately diagnose a patient with disorders of consciousness. What happens is that when we are in the acute care phase, right, there is a lot going on. Patients are, you know, we're fine one day to the next. The family is dealing with a lot of information. And we know that they're presented with withdrawal of care compassionately when we have catastrophic brain injuries. I think somewhere upwards of 70% of the deaths in a neurocritical ICU are compassionate withdrawals of care because of the poor prognosis. Unfortunately, with disorders of consciousness, there's not enough longitudinal studies to tell us what a long-term outcome will be with the patient. But just recently in the news, a case was brought back to light. Terry Wallace was a teenager when he sustained a traumatic brain injury as a result of a car accident in 1984. And his family wanted to maintain care. And he was ultimately transitioned to a skilled nursing facility. And 19 years later, in 2003, he woke up and started talking. And so this was one of those miracle cases where a lot of people didn't quite understand how it happened. But what we now know, looking back at Terry's case and all of the events that were documented between, you know, his 19-year stay in the skilled nursing facility, we know that he was minimally conscious and he progressed slowly through that level to consciousness when he was able to communicate. And I just recently heard that, you know, TBIs have better prognosis typically than anoxic brain injuries when it comes to disorders of consciousness. They have an upwards slow progression, much like a stroke progression, where we will see minute advances over time.
You're talking about as far as with an anoxic injury versus a traumatic brain injury, the slow progression over time?
Absolutely. So you'll see a more, I guess, pronounced recovery or they have a better prognosis with traumatic brain injury. But it, like I said, in Terry Wallace's case, he was diagnosed as vegetative and sent to a nursing home to live out the rest of his days and not giving the appropriate care or even compassion. And so you can imagine that for 19 years, you're aware of what is going on around you, but just not really able to interact. Or maybe you are interacting, but the people that are caring for you are not looking for those subtle signs that you are there and trying to communicate with them.
I'm going to share a quick story of an example of what you're talking about, kind of with the anoxic injury and the longer recovery period. And that was the area I worked in also when I was working clinically, was trauma units, and worked with a lot of traumatic brain injuries, anoxic injuries. And in that area, I saw quite a number of people with, at the time, we called them vegetative state versus the current, more current disorder of consciousness. I have one case that always stood out in my mind of a woman who had an anoxic injury. Therefore, her prognosis was poorer than some of our patients who had the traumatic brain injury diagnosis. She had had a very severe anoxic injury and was minimally responsive, some eye opening, you know, not localizing to sound or light. We were not getting a lot of from her in the acute care setting. We made the determination as a team, we did not provide services in the acute care setting because her insurance and what she had available to her was very limited on the amount of allied health services, PTOT, speech, and all that she could get. So she was fitted for a wheelchair, some basic things, because she was able to get up out of bed and sit upright occasionally with appropriate supports. She was discharged to a SNF and was receiving kind of minimal care at the SNF. After about a year's time, she actually came into outpatient for assessments and all, and she was now more awake and was starting to attempt to talk and was sitting up in the wheelchair without the extent of the support she'd had. She had gotten some services in the SNF, but was coming back to outpatient for more extensive services. And we even were doing a swallowing evaluation on her to look at getting her back to some PO because she had advanced so much. But it took almost a year before she and I, people can't see me do air quotes, but she woke up, kind of long progression. And when we saw her, when she came back, we were very glad we hadn't used up her services because she came in and still had quite a lot available to her as far as services and on, and had made great progress. But for her, it took about a year. Others, it can take much longer, you know, before they kind of, with anoxic injuries, they don't follow quite that same pattern that we see when we think about traumatic brain injury and people having the Ranchos levels, you know, if you use those and they start at one in a coma and then progress to two and then to three and kind of slowly, you know, go through these documented recovery stages that have been shown to occur with traumatic brain injury. So I'm glad you kind of brought up that distinction. When you see in your setting, you've got the patient with disorders of consciousness, do you have any hints for helping to decide? Because you were talking about this particular patient who was maybe more aware than they were aware of. You mentioned locked in, which is a whole nother category. What do you use as criteria or parameters to help you figure out where they are in that recovery process and whether or not they're going to gain and have benefit from direct therapies and interventions? Like what are your processes for that?
That's a really great question. And I will say that continuing care hospital is a long-term acute care hospital. So we are still very much in an acute phase, but maybe the patient is a little less critical, but still very much involved. When we have a patient that is coming to us with a case history that could potentially lead them to a disorder subconsciousness diagnosis, we will seek a speech therapy consult to evaluate. One of the things that we as a speech therapist on a disorder subconsciousness team or is trying to create a disorder subconsciousness team is that we really have to think critically and have a peripheral view of what we typically see as patients and really work to overcome the barriers that people in our professions or other medical disciplines have regarding early intervention in the ICU. I am a great proponent of clinicians being in the ICU and working towards progress. When I have a patient whose case history is leaning towards a potential disorders of consciousness, the first thing we do is going in, right? Look at the patient, observe the patient. What are they doing just on their own, lack of stimulation, just them, just in the bed, what's happening? And then we'll look at our case, we'll discuss it with the physicians and say, you know, can we be cleared for inline speaking valve if the patient is on the ventilator? Because we know there are so many benefits and things of that sort that we research for the passing ear speaking valve. So why not try it with these patients? And I know that that can be somewhat of a barrier for clinicians in that we know that speaking valve should not be used during sleep, but there is a distinction between sleep and a disorders of consciousness. And so that's something that I feel like I've now developed a soapbox for. And I'm definitely advocating for utilizing a speaking valve early on, because we know there's so many benefits for its use, as well as when we are formally assessing this patient to determine if we do have a disorders of consciousness and in which state that they are in. We know that the use of a passing ear speaking valve helps restore the sensation that is being tested in the formal protocols of the coma recovery scale revised.
That is a question that we get a lot. And you're correct that with the speaking valve, it does say that it should not be used during sleep. And disorders of consciousness is a different category or different area. Those patients aren't asleep. They just aren't cognitively as interactive with their environment. And I think you're making a nice distinction there between the two. What are some signs to you when you go in the patient's room? Like, what are some signs to you as you look at that patient? How do you help make that determination of kind of where they are and their appropriateness for assessment or treatment? How do you decide kind of where to start with?
Definitely just using the principles of early intervention in the ICU, and then, you know, the principles of neurocritical care, and that time is brain, and that we know that we've had such interventions in treatment of brain injury, such as craniectomies, that inhibit herniation and increase the likelihood of survival. So we know that severe brain injury has the potential to improve. And we know that through, you know, several studies in several populations regarding acquired brain injury, whether that be anoxic, traumatic, or polytrauma, we know those things. And so if we utilize that information and kind of assimilate it to the population of disorders of consciousness, we have a pathway of moving forward to helping them. Definitely, there are assessments out there. There is the coma recovery scale revised, the coma near coma, as well as several other ones out there. But we know that the CRSR is the gold standard. And so it's a protocol that goes through different stimulation tasks to see if the patient responds meaningfully. Right. And so we're testing auditory, sensation, vestibular, all of those things in which we can try to see the patient respond to us. We also look for informal observations from care staff in different times of the day. We ask family members to write a journal and tell us, what are you seeing at what parts of the day? So it's definitely looking at things with a magnifying glass, trying to delineate correlation and causation and all of those things. And we work towards those things to help individualize the care. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the most important things that I have learned in disorders of consciousness care, is that there's not really a one size fits all. There is definitely needs to individualize the care so that we are looking at what the patient is specifically able to do, what this patient who's in front of us is responding to, and so forth. So it does take a lot of multidisciplinary collaboration to determine the patient's form of response. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the things, we always assimilate the cranial nerve exam with dysphagia, or typically do, but I am looking at cranial nerves to see what's happening, because maybe the patient isn't opening their eyes because the cranial nerve is not working anymore because of the traumatic brain injury. And so they don't have that eye opening. So they aren't in coma. Maybe they are minimally conscious, but they can't show me by opening their eyes. right? And so that's a form of that individualized care. We have to see what is the patient in front of me able to do and why or why not. We also have to also understand that we have the critical illness myopathy playing into it, or we have paralysis playing into it as well.
Well, one thing that I know I had always tried to do and I still recommend to people, and it kind of fits, I think, with what you're saying about individualizing, but you have to keep, in this patient population especially, pretty systematic and clean records. You mentioned having everybody document because you have to see if that response is a consistent response. Do they always do a certain thing for a certain stimulation or do they not? And it helps you start formulating kind of what you're seeing and what you're doing with that patient. I only say that because you mentioned everyone on your team is documenting. You get the family documenting, keeping a journal. You know, the nurses are maintaining some of that information. And so getting a broader picture of what they're responding to, when they respond, they may respond better in the morning than the afternoon, or the afternoon more so than the morning. You know, so there's just all kinds of factors that could play into what you're doing with them.
Yes, absolutely. And one of the tools that can be used with the Disorders of Consciousness program is the IQBA, which is an individualized quantitative behavioral assessment. So those are basically, it's a protocol that's developed for the patient, and it's designed to answer the questions that are specific for the patient. So what is this patient doing? How are they doing it? When are they doing it? And to what extent? So that's definitely something that is a tool that can be used to help kind of reduce the sampling error or the variability of the behaviors. So it's more structured and can be followed no matter what clinician is administering it. And you did make a good point about different times of the day. And that's one of the things that needs to be done, is that assessment needs to be done in different parts of the day. And it also, it's a little bit different than what we know of regarding diagnosis, right? With disorders of consciousness, we diagnose it based on the highest level of behavior or reaction. Or, you know, if the patient moves his arm and reaches for an object, right, has that intentional response, then that day we are documenting that the patient is minimally conscious. And then tomorrow, you know, maybe the patient isn't responding to that object and isn't trying to grab for it. So we will go back and say, well, what was different today? Oh, they had an episode of respiratory distress this morning, or medication was administered at this time or than this time because of this event. What happened that changed from day to day? So it's almost like a continuous science experiment. So if you're somebody that likes to do that, this is definitely an interesting population to test those skills and to exercise the scientific method.
Let's touch base a little bit more on, you mentioned in early intervention in the ICU and patients on ventilators. I know sometimes we hear, oh, they don't need a speaking valve because they're not speaking. So let's talk a little bit about why we would start early intervention and potentially use a valve in line on the ventilator, or if they've even been weaned off the ventilator. If they're in this minimally conscious state, why would we look at putting the valve on? What are some of the things that you've found or that your team considers when you look at using a speaking valve?
If I had a nickel for every time I heard that, I would be a very rich woman. Why not use the speaking valve? Maybe they aren't demonstrating what you and I would think is intent to communicate, right? So that's just the general term. They're not awake, moving, wiggling, using gestures to use a speaking valve, or they're planning on weaning from the vent or trying a spontaneous breathing trial tomorrow, so we're not even going to try the speaking valve. You know, obviously we need a physician order and physician collaboration with an inline speaking valve atop of respiratory therapy and other disciplines, but we know that we are providing a more normal upper airway for the patient, so they are able to experience air flowing through the glottis. What if they are trying to groan or moan, or they're trying to, but we're not hearing them, right? We're not hearing them because the cuff is inflated. There's no air going through the vocal cords and they're completely aphonic. But we slowly deflate the cuff, we put on the speaking valve, and these patients are groaning, or maybe they burp or they cough spontaneously. That is internal stimulation that can help progress the patient towards the next level of consciousness. And even if we're not looking at a patient with disorders of consciousness, we're giving that patient the opportunity to cough, to burp, to have that air pass through their glottis, to say something. I've always seen that wonderful elation where they're able to express themselves, right? It's almost like I've always compared it to when a cochlear implant is activated for the first time and you see the, you know, the patient's head turn and you know that they've heard something, right? You see that same glow and like, oh my gosh, that's my voice. Let me tell you something, or call my wife or get the phone. And it's so great to see that. And that's one of those things that we'll get through those tough days when you get that win for the patient. But we know that the speaking valve provides numerous benefits. And I always try to focus with the physical therapy that we are restoring subglottic pressure that helps with core stability, right? This is going to help with transitioning. If you're walking the patient on the vent, we're going to give them better stability and balance if they're walking on the vent with a speaking valve in line. And I learned those principles, thankfully, through Mary Massery, who is a physical therapist that has coined the soda pop can diagram and helping, you know, understand that the vocal cords, the diaphragm, the pelvic floor, all of those things are affected when we have an open airway like a tracheostomy.
I'm glad you mentioned Mary Massery's work, because that's definitely a great resource for people if they're listening, both her publications and she teaches or has all-day seminars, which teach those principles of how we breathe matters idea and that it affects trunk support, postural control. So that's a really nice resource for people. You mentioned doing kind of sensory stimulation, you know, working with these patients early on and doing some structured stimulation with them. You're also looking at things like taste and smell, if you're trying to use those at all with these patients to provide some stimulation if they've got an open trach tube and aren't breathing through their glottis and their upper airway, their taste and smell may be diminished or even absent without that airflow stimulation to help with it. And that may be something that you could actually use in as you work with the patient, you know, to provide some stimulation. So yeah, there's definitely a few ways that it can help. When you work with this patient population, what would be a piece of advice based on your experiences and what you've done? What's some advice you would give to a speech language pathologist who's thinking of, you know, I really need to be helping this patient population in my facility. How do I get it started? Would you have some ideas for getting started with this patient population?
Well, I definitely have two sides of that story. I'll have the clinical side and then, you know, the administrative side. So the clinical side is, you know, how can I get this patient to speak or have functional communication sooner? How can I get them to return to oral intake sooner? And what effect does that have on their disposition plans? And what effect does that have on their resources? Right? If we can get the patient to eat by mouth sooner, then maybe we don't have to consider a PEG, or maybe we can discontinue tube feeding sooner, right? How does that help the patient in the immediate time and place? If you are looking for buy-in from administration, you definitely have to look at what are their metrics that they're looking at? What are the key performance indexes that they are focusing on for the year or for the next 5 years? What's their long-term goal? If they're saying, you know, we want to reduce length of stay, you know, then we'll say, we know the speaking valve helps facilitate liberation from the ventilator because it restores PEEP. It helps provide more diaphragmatic intervention and things of that sort. We're getting the patient off the ventilator. We know that a patient ventilator day is this much every day. So if we can limit it by 2 days, this is what we're saving, right? Or if we are talking about the tube feeding cost, right? How much does tube feeding cost, or how many times do we have to do a chest x-ray again to make sure that that Dobhoff tube is in the correct location? So how can we reduce the patient's exposure to radiation? How can we improve patient satisfaction by being able to communicate and manage pain, or to communicate and manage anxiety or just basic care instruction. So if we're looking at those KPIs, then perhaps you can get buy-in a little bit faster. But it definitely is not going to happen overnight. You have to be persistent. You have to have a plan and do your research, right? Because you have to get buy-in. You have to be able to get people to sit down, listen, and think about what you're saying, and then implement it or give you the tools or the resources to be able to move forward with your plan. It definitely took me upwards of 2 years to get a respiratory muscle training program, but it was not without diligence and persistence. And definitely I am working towards establishing a disorders of consciousness formal program here at our LTAC, so that way we can continue to serve the community appropriately and adjust to the needs of our patients.
Well, thank you. I hope that the listeners were able to, and I know they did, garner some nuggets they can take from that on disorders of consciousness. You threw a lot of good information in there about some potential assessment tools, some of the research that supports it. And I would like to see more people able to treat these patients and getting involved earlier in their care. I think it's a disservice if we're not helping these patients in their lower levels with their disorders of consciousness. Thank you, Ashley, for joining and sharing about your work in this area and then sharing it with all the listeners so they can have some ideas moving forward.
Absolutely. I will say that in all of my years of practice, I have never been welcomed in so graciously and so openly by the community who focuses on disorders of consciousness. I have, you know, I reached out to the leaders in this care and they responded and were more than willing to help me. So I definitely would say, like, if you are truly interested in the disorders of consciousness or wanting to advocate for this patient population, you are going to be supported and welcomed by the leaders who are doing the research, who are pioneering, and you can have that support unlike any other discipline or pathway in our profession. I can't say thank you enough to all of them who have been so gracious to me and holding my hand through all of these things. And I hope that one day I can return the favor to another clinician and give them the insight that I've been given.
Well, thank you. And I actually think today you've done a little bit of that, given back by sharing some of your insights. But thank you very much for joining. And thank you everyone for listening in on this talk with Ashley about disorders of consciousness.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.